plus the segregationist roots of school choice and headlines on the Green New Deal. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate. And now stay tuned for On the Ground Radio.
From Washington, D.C., this is On the Ground. On today's show, fact versus fiction in the life of President George H.W. Bush. We speak to historian and author Gerald Horn.
In an utterly cynical move, and he should have known better, as a CIA director, he was involved up to his eyeballs in covert actions in Southern Africa, collaborating with the apartheid regime of South Africa.
And public education advocate Diane Ravitch reveals how the so-called school choice movement, boosted by Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos, was born in segregationist white academies of the South.
I think in all of these situations, the basic rule should be follow the money. Like the Walton family is now worth $175 billion. The Walton family has opened more charter schools than any other institution or group in the country.
All that and much more coming up.
Unlike commercial television, this event is not sponsored by ExxonMobil.
Welcome to On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, Voices of Resistance from the nation's capital. I'm Esther Averam. And between the sacking of Mark Lamont Hill by CNN last week for telling the truth about the apartheid state of Israel, to this week's coverage of omission on the life of George Herbert Walker Bush, it's clear more than ever that corporate media is not even pretending to distribute news. But here we are all about that news. And let's start with an update on Professor Hill, whose eloquent Palestine solidarity speech at the United Nations we played in full on last week's show. More than 30 members of the faculty at Temple University, where Hill teaches, have signed an open letter voicing no confidence in the chairman of the board of the university, Patrick O'Connor. They said in the letter that O'Connor, in attacking Hill and even calling for his firing, is violating Hill's right to academic freedom, contained in the school's contract with its professors. The faculty members wrote in part, quote, "We are faculty at Temple University writing in support of Mark Lamont Hill's academic freedom to express his views on the Israeli occupation of Palestine. We thought his arguments were passionate, considered, and thoughtful, and respected the humanity of Palestinians and Israelis. Regardless if we agree or disagree with him, we support his freedom to espouse his views." The letter continues, "If anyone is guilty of violating Temple's clause on academic freedom, it is O'Connor. His comments were not restrained, he did not show respect for Hill's opinions, and he flagrantly misrepresented his views as those of everyone at Temple. Most egregiously, O'Connor undermined academic freedom by implying that firing Hill was desirable and or in process. Academic freedom is a bedrock principle of academia. O'Connor has betrayed that principle, and we have no confidence in his leadership of the board," end quote. To listen to Hill's complete speech at the UN, go to our website, onthegroundshow.org. And this week, incoming freshman member of Congress, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York, continued to show her leadership on the issue of climate change. Speaking about her Green New Deal resolution on Monday night, she compared it to the New Deal of the 1930s at a packed town hall sponsored by Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders.
You know, when we think about where we were when the New Deal was established, we were a nation in depression, in Great Depression. We were a nation on the brink of war. We saw the rise of fascism creeping across in Europe. And no one would thought that a nation so poor, so scarce, and so in such dire straits as we were in that time could pursue such a bold economic agenda. But we chose to do it anyway. We had the courage to do it anyway. And that is what this moment demands of us right now. That's what we have to do. We have to, this is going to be the great society, the moonshot, the civil rights movement of our generation. That is the scale. That is the scale of the ambition that this movement is going to require.
The town hall occurred the same week that the Senate confirmed a fossil fuel defender, Bernard McAmey, to sit on the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. And as new research shows that after being flat for 3 years, carbon emissions are actually increasing and have done so during the past 2 years. Even though she is not yet sworn in, Ocasio-Cortez has already released a resolution for a Green New Deal to aggressively develop non-fossil fuel sources of energy while creating good-paying jobs for millions of Americans. And a follow to our story last week about the jobs and services at the planned new hospital for Wards 7 and 8 in D.C. The D.C. Council voted Tuesday to require that George Washington University Hospital, owned by Universal Health Services, honor union contracts and employ healthcare workers from the current hospital, United Medical Center. The council also voted to require the new hospital to allow Howard University medical students and doctors to practice at the hospital as they do now. In response to the vote, George Washington University Hospital has indicated that they may withdraw from the deal. Yane Barner, vice president of 1199 United Healthcare Workers East, which represents staff members at UMC, told On the Ground that the community objects to the fact that GWU is not required to adhere to the same processes of transparency and community hearings to build the new hospital. And as part of the deal, a new 270-bed facility at its current Northwest DC location. Quote, "We are pleased that the council listened to constituents and amended the East End Health Equity Act to protect quality union jobs and is postponing the vote on the act," Barner said. "But these changes are not enough. Clearly, this legislation needs more discussion, scrutiny, and improvement, and we are still concerned that there are no guarantees that specialty services like cardiac and cancer care will be offered at the new hospital. Moving forward, the community and workers need to have a seat at the table for healthcare discussions and decisions that affect them," end quote, Barner said. And finally, in culture and media, as the U.S.-made refugee crisis on the border with Mexico continues, there was a reading in D.C. this week from a new book about U.S. interventions in South America. Chantel James has more.
In Plan Colombia, U.S. Ally Atrocities and Community Activism, John Lindsay Poland details the 50-year U.S.-backed war in the nation of Colombia that claimed over 200,000 lives. At the Potter's House on Tuesday, the author was in conversation with Diana Sanchez, an attorney with the Colombian human rights organization Minga, about the history of U.S. military backing for the atrocities of the Colombian government against civilians. Poland reads from the end of his book here, warning of the lessons and implications of Plan Colombia and the dangers of American exceptionalism.
Plan Colombia will not be the last multi-billion dollar commitment by the United States to war through assistance to other nations' military forces. As military policymakers support actors they dub the, quote, good guys, many outcomes of that support have implicated the United States in crimes committed against civilians. But American exceptionalism leads most people in the United States, especially those who are above, to overlook, to forget, or simply to never inquire about those implications.
From Northwest DC, this is Chantal James.
Also on culture and media, the DC Metro Coalition in solidarity with the Cuban Revolution presents The Return of the Grandma Ship, a fundraiser commemorating the 62nd anniversary of the sailing of the Granma from Mexico to Santiago de Cuba on December 1st, 1956. And that will happen from 6 to 10 p.m. at the Everlasting Life Cafe in Capitol Heights, Maryland. And finally, in culture and media, Monday, December 10th is the deadline for the House of Representatives to reverse the FCC's deeply unpopular repeal of net neutrality, which allows equal access to all websites and online properties. The campaign to reverse the repeal of net neutrality is continuing, and for more information, go to deadlinefornetneutrality.com. And those are headlines and happenings. When we come back, Gerald Horn joins us. Stay with us.
Journal with a hard times, tales from the dark side, evidence of the settlements on my hard drive. Man, I swear my heart died at the end of that car ride. When I saw that checkpoint, welcome to apartheid. Soldiers wear military green at the checkpoint. Automatic guns, that's machine at the checkpoint. Tables not M16s at the checkpoint. Fingers on the trigger, you get leaned at the checkpoint. Little children, grown adults and teens at the checkpoint. All your papers better be clean at the checkpoint. Gotta put your finger on the screen at the checkpoint and pray that red light turns green at the checkpoint. And Martin Luther King had a dream on the checkpoint. He wake with loud screams from the scenes at the checkpoint. Is Malcolm X by any means at the checkpoint? Imagine if your daily routine was the checkpoint.
And Martin Luther King had a dream on the checkpoint. He wake with loud screams from the scenes at the checkpoint. Is Malcolm X by any means at the checkpoint? Imagine if your daily routine was the checkpoint. Separation walls, that's...
This is On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, Voices of Resistance from the nation's capital. I'm Esther Iverum. Well, after public funeral services here in D.C. on Wednesday for the late President George Herbert Walker Bush, a private service was held on Thursday in Texas, and afterward, Bush's casket was carried to a family burial plot at Bush's Presidential Library on the campus of Texas A&M University in College Station, Texas. The final services for the 41st president follows a week of 24-hour mainstream media coverage praising Bush for his quote-unquote decency and civility and for being a lifelong public servant. It was left to a small number of alternative progressive media outlets and voices to offer historical fact-based coverage of the legacy of Bush's impact on the world. Well, joining me for this discussion is one of those voices, On the Ground's regular contributor, the prolific author, Gerald Horn, professor of history and African American studies at the University of Houston. Welcome back to the show, Gerald.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, first, like I just mentioned, it has been left to alternative media to really take a look at the time period from, I think, 1988 to 1992 when George H.W. Bush was president. So I guess I want to first ask you, what's been missing from the news reports that most Americans have heard?
Well, what's been missing could fill up this entire hour. I'm in favor, like many others, of scoring points against the current U.S. President, Donald J. Trump. But I'm not in favor of a miscarriage of history, that is to say, elevating the tainted image of George Herbert Walker Bush in order to make these points against Donald Trump. I mean, first of all, look at his family. As is well known, his father, Prescott Bush, was in bed with Nazis during World War II. His grandfather was part of the military-industrial complex, accelerating during World War I, 1914 to 1918. Mr. Bush himself voted against the Civil Rights Act of 1964. He promoted this rather sordid image of Willie Horton seeking to scare white voters by putting forward an image in campaign ads of a so-called black criminal. He elevated Clarence Thomas to the U.S. Supreme Court, the most reactionary member of that court, in an utterly cynical move, and he should have known better. As a CIA director, he was involved up to his eyeballs in covert actions in Southern Africa, collaborating with the apartheid regime of South Africa. But what I find even more troubling in terms of his legacy is that the Bush Presidential Library, where he will be buried alongside his spouse, Barbara Bush, in College Station, Texas, is one of the more secretive of the presidential libraries. And I've basically done research at them all, which is quite unfortunate because we need to know more about the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989 when he was president. We need to know more about the collapse of the Soviet Union in December 1991 when he was president. And it'll take quite a bit of prodding and pressure to get that library to disgorge its secrets. And that's part of the tainted legacy of one George H.W. Bush.
So it's interesting that you mentioned that era, the fall of the Soviet Union. At some point, Bush heralded what he called the New World Order. And so I'm wondering if he was president during the first of years of what they called a unipolar world, when the U.S. was the only so-called superpower, and how he impacted that time.
Well, obviously he was critical, but keep in mind as well that he was an ambassador to China at a time when the United States was working out an entente with Beijing on an anti-Soviet basis, which was thought to be a stroke of genius on the part of then U.S. President Richard M. Nixon. But given the fact that the payoff to China was massive direct foreign investment, which has created this gargantuan juggernaut, it may turn out to be the exact opposite. And George H.W. Bush has that on his record as well.
And I had to remember Haiti and the overthrow of the democratically elected government of Jean-Bertrand Aristide during that time. And there were so many interventions around the world during his presidency that you have to kind of look back historically to kind of remember them all, in terms of Panama, Haiti, of course, the first Gulf War, and the atrocities committed in Iraq, and the whole lead up to that in terms of the PR spin to, you know, claim that Saddam Hussein was like killing babies in Kuwait. So, but in terms of the what we call the Global South now, what are some of the things that are still having an impact today?
Well, I mean, look at Iraq. I mean, Iraq has barely recovered. Perhaps it will never recover. Perhaps it will be difficult for it to recover, not only from the sledgehammer blows inflicted by the first George Bush, but the follow-up by his son in 2003, which created fertile conditions for the rise of religious zealotry, which massacred tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands. Certainly, Haiti is still reeling from the fact that a progressive president, Mr. Aristide, was dislodged, virtually kidnapped, and dropped off in Africa. And look at Panama, the kidnapping, arrest, detention of the leader, Manuel Noriega, manacling him, dragging off him in handcuffs to a prison in the United States. What country could withstand such a blow? And this is all part of the sordid, tainted legacy of George H.W. Bush.
As an historian and someone who has written so many books that have, I think, corrected the narrative, the historical narrative that passes for truth in this country, I'm wondering how, in particular, you look at this coverage as a writer. I start to feel sometimes in D.C. like I'm in the Twilight Zone when you turn on the TV and you hear, you know, these eulogies, these speeches given this week. Do you find that people generally believe this in terms of their worldview? Are they knowledgeable of the history and just ignoring it in these speeches? Or are they just ignorant of the history? What is it?
I think it's mostly the latter, certainly for those tens of millions who voted for Mr. Trump. In the first instance, it's difficult to give them any credit when it comes to intellectual candle power. But on the other hand, I have to say that I looked differently at the eulogies towards Mr. Bush as opposed to those leveled at Mr. Reagan. I think it was worse, the eulogies directed at Mr. Reagan. And the reason that I look at the Bush eulogies differently, because as I noted at the top, I think that the anti-Trump media is trying to score points against Donald J. Trump. And I'm all in favor of scoring points against Donald J. Trump. But of course, the poison in the package is this miscarriage of history and trying to elevate him. And that's what we're left with. That is to say, this poison that is being directed at a goal that many of us could support, that is to say, bringing down Donald J. Trump a peg or two.
So I was thinking about the historians that they allow on to, you know, cable news. And I saw just a snippet of a speech given by John Meacham, a presidential historian. And so, you know, as an historian yourself, what are they doing in their work that allows them to, is it just a different worldview that they actually believe that these excursions and invasions around the world are actually good for America or in our interest? Is it just that simple that we're dealing with people who are imperialists and they are viewing the world as imperialists?
I think the simple and short answer is yes. I think that if a person's paycheck is dependent upon a certain worldview, you can expect them to espouse that worldview that keeps those checks being deposited in their bank account. That may sound cynical, it may sound mercenary, but I'm afraid to say that ultimately that's what it boils down to.
Okay, well, I guess that would take us all the way back to where we started in terms of the media coverage that we've been subjected to for the past week. This is On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, Voices of Resistance from the Nation's Capital. I'm Esther Averam, and I'm in conversation with our geopolitical analyst, Professor Gerald Horn. And Gerald, in addition to the death of George Herbert Walker Bush, which we just discussed, there was the inauguration of a new president in Mexico. So why don't you talk about that and its significance now?
Well, I have to say, it seems rare and unusual for us to have good news to discuss in our conversations, but this is really good news. The inauguration on December 1 of Andrés Manuel López Obrador as the new president of Mexico, elected actually months ago, but there's this interregnum between the election and the inauguration. Certainly, he's probably the most progressive Mexican leader since President Cárdenas of the 1930s, who nationalized Yankee oil interests in Mexico. Already he's moving to hike upwards the pensions of the elderly. He's launched a campaign against the impunity that has been enjoyed by too many Mexican leaders. And I guess, and I hope, that he would do something about this recent award to Jared Kushner, the U.S. president's son-in-law, of Mexico's highest civilian order, which in many ways was a slap in the face of the Mexican people. It was also heartening to see that President Maduro of Venezuela was at the inauguration. Already you can see taking shape a renewed progressive bloc in Latin America, including, of course, the Cubans, the Bolivians, the Venezuelans, and perhaps the Nicaraguans as well. This would be juxtaposed to this Yankee bloc led by the United States, and including most recently Brazil and their reactionary leader, Mr. Bolsonaro. So this election is very significant. I would encourage our friends on the left and in the Black Liberation Movement to take delegations to Mexico City to meet with their counterparts. And I say this not only because that's in our self-interest, but also to express solidarity with this new regime, which inevitably will face destabilization from Washington, D.C.
Well, speaking of destabilization, I saw a news item about Canada arresting a Chinese corporate leader, Meng Wanzhou. And it looked like this leader in the same tech corporation that's been targeted in terms of kind of boycotts by the West. Can you break that down?
Well, you're talking about the chief financial officer of Huawei, which is a competitor in terms of smartphones with Apple and is a world leader in terms of telecommunications infrastructure, competing with Cisco, amongst other U.S. corporations. I think that this arrest is part and parcel of this new Cold War against China, inaugurated perhaps on October 4th by a speech by Vice President Michael Pence in Washington, or a subsequent speech he gave at the Asia Pacific Economic Summit in Papua New Guinea on November 17th. It's a reflection of the fact that Washington is going to find it difficult to compete economically with China. That was the import of a very fascinating op-ed written by former Harvard University President and Treasury Secretary Lawrence Summers in the Financial Times. And what it's left with is this kind of guerrilla warfare. That is to say, trying to arrest and detain Chinese leaders. Just the other day, in a New York City federal court, another Chinese leader was convicted of violating U.S. laws with regard to supposedly offering bribes to an African leader, a Chadian leader. A chief witness against him was a former Senegalese leader, and I don't think that that particular testimony by the Senegalese leader went down very well in light of the fact that China's just funded this massive museum of black civilization in Dakar, which in some ways makes the National African American History Museum in Washington, D.C. seem like the equivalent of the dollar store. So this arrest in Vancouver, Canada, is also putting in jeopardy not only Canada's relations with China, but I would also say it's putting in jeopardy U.S. corporate leaders in China itself, which includes Starbucks, KFC, Apple, Microsoft. I expect China to retaliate forcefully. The only good news I see coming out of this saga is that the conservative columnist Roger Simon pointed out that if these negotiations that the United States and China are involved in right now to tamp down this trade war don't go very well, the United States probably will be plunged into a deep recession, which could lead to the defeat in 2020 of one Donald J. Trump.
Well, we'll keep a watch on what's happening with that arrest. And I saw one report that said that there was a probable extradition to the U.S. So that's worth watching, and we certainly will. I've been speaking with our geopolitical analyst, Professor Gerald Horn. Thank you for joining me today, Gerald.
Thank you.
Mississippi Cindy Hyde-Smith recently won a special runoff election to retain her Senate seat despite having joked about a public hanging. Mississippi was once known as the country's lynching capital. Hyde-Smith's schooling offers context for a comment which is consistent with her past support for the Confederacy. According to the Jackson Free Press, Hyde-Smith was educated at a segregation academy and years later, as a parent, sent her daughter to another segregation academy. Meanwhile, Governor Phil Bryant, who initially appointed Hyde-Smith to her Senate seat, attended a similar school. I sat down with author and activist Diane Ravitch, who is one of the leading public school advocates. I began by asking her about the history of segregation academies, which fueled the school choice movement, which is still going strong today.
Well, the school choice movement was born in the South in the 1950s and 60s as a response to the Brown versus Board of Education decision. Southerners, white Southerners, did not want to desegregate their schools. And so they thought that the answer to preserve segregation would be to have school choice. They would say, if everyone chooses their own school, then whites will choose white schools, blacks will choose black schools, and we can maintain the status quo. And so that's the origin of the school that Cindy Hyde-Smith went to. It was created in 1970, and that was the first year in which the courts actually ordered Mississippi to desegregate and prove that it was desegregating. And so the school she went to was created that year. And many of the white Southerners used these segregation academies as a form of school choice. And these days, when people who advocate for charter schools are told of the history of school choice, they get very upset and they deny it, but that is the truth.
We're here in D.C. Next door in Virginia, in Prince Edward County, they had an interesting response to the Brown versus Board of Ed and being required to integrate schools.
Well, as I recall, they closed their schools and they went for years with no schools. And white kids got an education and black kids did not get an education. We're still paying for those horrible decisions.
As I said, we're here in D.C. where charter schools have taken off, as they have in much of the country. But bring us up to today, where the latest iteration of school choice is charter schools.
Well, charter schools are basically a substitute for vouchers. And the reason that they took off was because so many states had a prohibition against vouchers. The people who are against public schools have found a way to work around even those state constitutions that say you can't send public money to religious schools. About half the states now have voucher programs. But the charter idea originally was that charter schools would be more innovative, they would be more accountable, and they would produce real results. If they didn't produce results, they would close. But what we have seen over the past 25 years is they're not accountable. They don't have, for example, open meetings. Most charter school boards are private boards. They appoint themselves again and again. So they're not accountable either for money or for academics. There are failing charter schools that fail year after year, and no one has come up with an idea of what will replace a failing charter school other than another charter school. And they have produced no innovation. Their idea of an innovation is no excuses, which means to have the kind of harsh discipline and punishment that was commonplace in public schools, let's say, 100 years ago. So that's hardly innovative. It seems to me that it's going backwards.
And yet they often enjoy bipartisan support. Republican support may make sense. You're privatizing in some way a public good, but frequently there's Democratic support as well.
Well, the reason that charters get Democratic support is, I'd say that there are two reasons. One is because there are a lot of people giving money to Democratic politicians who want privatization of public schools. There's a group called Democrats for Education Reform, which gives money at the state and local level in political campaigns. And these are Wall Street people who are part of, they call it DEFER, Democrats for Education Reform is DEFER. And DEFER really has nothing to do with the Democratic Party. It just uses the name in its title. The state Democratic Party in both California and Colorado told DEFER to stop taking